Another parable Jesus put before the crowds. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed that someone took and sowed in his field. It is the smallest of all seeds, but when it has grown, it is the greatest of shrubs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches. He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed in with 3 measures of flour until all of it was leavened. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field, which someone found and hid. Then in his joy, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls. On finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that was thrown into the sea and caught fish of every kind. When it was full, they drew it ashore, sat down, and put the good into baskets, but threw out the bad. The Gospel of our Lord.
I have to tell you, folks, that we managed at the 8 o'clock service to skate by with that lesson, that passage from Genesis. The person that was reading didn't notice. I wasn't going to bring it up, and so it just never came up, but we can always count on Allison. And so here's the deal, but let me give it the wider context. I like to refer to this particular section of the book of Genesis and these several chapters that focus on Jacob, and to name them after my favorite soap opera, As the Stomach Turns. Because the main character, Jacob, I mean, this guy, he's a liar, he's a cheat, he's a thief, and so he gets his comeuppance from the father of Rachel and Leah, but then, you know, acts like a typical guy in the Hebrew scriptures. And of course, Allison noticed and picked up on the colloquialism when it made the reference to going into her. It's like, really, guys, you have to do it that way? I mean, and it's a good thing we don't really understand. I mean, I do because I've read the Hebrew, but you guys don't understand all the colloquialisms and the weird references to sexual activity, and you would be shocked and appalled if you were. I mean, there's rape, there's incest, there, you know, multiple relationships. I mean, the swingers of the 60s had nothing on these ancient ones. I mean, on and on it goes. Wife swapping, slave swapping, you know, concubines, etc. And for God's sake, don't touch anybody's feet. That's all I'm going to say about that. But in the meantime, this soap opera, this liar, cheat, and thief gets his comeuppance, and then he gets all in Laban's or Laban's face. You know, oh, you set me up. It's like, yeah, just like you set up your brother Esau. And by the way, the reason he's even with this family in the first place is he's running from his brother because he ripped them off, right? We heard that story last week or the week before. And he's right on the verge. I mean, this is the point, which is why I refer to this whole section of Genesis as the Stomach Turns. He's right on the verge of becoming completely and irrevocably paranoid in the clinical sense. And if there were clinical psychologists or psychiatrists back in the day, this whole family, I guarantee, would be on somebody's couch because they're all a little... So each generation comes by their dysfunction and their mental challenges, honestly, from the very beginning. I mean, the whole thing is just this unending soap opera. And the good news is that somehow, throughout it all the weirdness, all the potentially diagnosable mental illnesses, through all of it, God sort of quietly weaves in and through, and in ways that can't be predicted or even explained, the will of God and the compassion of God come through the story and through the lives of these various wacky characters. And so, anyway, thought I'd throw that out. And here's the other piece of it. If you continue on, and God bless the women of these stories, they do not go silent. When they are abused physically or sexually or emotionally, they consistently cry out to God. They are not going to go silent. And if there's any, you know, lesson we can draw from these stories as we continue the reading, is pay attention to the women. Because, yeah, they're used, yes, they're abused, and they speak out. They're not going to put up with it. So, there's that. And then we come to these parables that continue on in the Gospel according to Matthew. Now these little snippets that the author and this ancient community of Matthew have drawn together in a very particular sort of way. Probably originally they were just random stories that Jesus told around and about as he was traveling and people were following him. And so we have a series of these. The kingdom of heaven, he says, is like a mustard seed, yeast, and a woman, treasure hidden in a field that somebody finds, a merchant who finds a pearl, and fishermen with a big net. And again, unfortunately, if you continue to read, several of these, not all of them, a couple of them remain untouched. Yay, that's a good thing. Several of them are interpreted by the author and in a way that is really deeply unhelpful. And so we've just left all that stuff off. I mean, you're free to read and if you like, to moralize these stories. But I'm here to tell you, Jesus never shared these stories with people as morality plays. They're parables. They're windows into the presence of God. And if you will, seeing the world from a God's eye perspective. And each of them, in their weird little way, is a story of extravagance. So let's go back and take a look at that. So the mustard seed, for instance, Jesus says, when it is grown, a tiny little seed, becomes the greatest of shrubs and becomes a tree. The ancient ones would have known that was total baloney. The little tiny mustard seed actually in the Middle East grows into this tiny, scruffy little shrub of no significance whatsoever. But the original hearers of this story would have gone, yes, we'll go for the tree. We vote for the tree because a giant, and I was trying to remember which kind of tree, and I can't recall. But a giant tree was one of a number of symbols for the power of Imperial Rome. And so Jesus is telling this story and going, nah. Watch the mustard seed. Yeah, everybody knows it's this scruffy little shrub, but in the story, we're going to make it a tree, and everybody's going to get excited because that's how God would, you know, have it. And everybody goes, woohoo, yes, go for the tree. And then the kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed with 3 measures of flour. I looked it up. 3 measures of flour in the first century of the Common Era is 50 pounds of flour. Now, I'm not a baker. Is anybody here? There's got to be a baker. Is there a baker here? I mean, can you imagine this woman? She would have been one tough lady, I'm imagining. I mean, 50 pounds of flour? That's like half a bag of cement. 100-pound bag. That's a lot of flour. And she's kneading this yeast in to make how many loaves of bread? Can anybody help me with this? How much bread would this have made? Tons, right? I think Chris Ritger from the 8 o'clock service, she's a baker, and she goes once a year to Costco and buys the 50-pound bag of flour and uses it for a whole year. She gets a whole year's use out of it, and she bakes pretty consistently, except maybe in the warm summer months. But otherwise, that's a lot of flour. Again, a story of extravagance. And as Jesus is wont, he's using these odd characters, this woman who is a baker. And she embodies the kingdom of heaven. Go figure. And then kingdom of heaven is like, and by the way, I hope we flag this. This is not about dying and going to heaven. Okay? The gospel according to Matthew uses the phrase the kingdom of heaven rather than the kingdom of God, because this is a bunch of Jewish people. This is the Jewish gospel, if you will, and they're not allowed to use the word God in public. So this author substitutes heaven for that. But make no mistake, it's not about dying and going to heaven. It's about living life on the hoof. So the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field. Now, I've pointed out probably more than once that this story is told by someone, Jesus, who is living in exile in his own land with a whole bunch of people who are also living in exile in their own land, told and retold and written down by a people who have remained exiles in their own land under the boot heel of Imperial Rome. They've lost everything. They've lost their homes, they've lost their fields, they've lost their crops, and the only way they're allowed by Imperial Rome to continue to till their own or some neighbor's field, assuming that they're even still alive. I mean, the reason Jesus tells the story the way he does is because probably the neighbor has been killed, probably been crucified by Imperial Rome already. And so now this person, this farmer, is tilling the neighbor's field and finds a treasure. And Imperial Rome would have claimed that field as their own. That farmer would only get to till that land if the produce was given over to the soldiers, the very ones that are oppressing them in the first place, right? The legions of Rome. So there's deep and abiding irony going on here. And again, the original hearers in the first century would have heard this about a farmer who finds a treasure in a field, the field belonging to Imperial Rome, hides the treasure, and they would have been going, yes, yes, hide it from the power that is oppressing us. And then figure out a way to finagle, maybe cut a deal with, you know, some legionnaire, get enough money together to buy that field, which would have been difficult, if not completely impossible. Again, Rome had conscripted all of the arable land in the Palestine. So these hearers are going, oh my God, this is not just a story about extravagance. It is also about social justice. Okay? And then Jesus goes on, kingdom of heaven is like a net thrown into the sea, and then those who caught the fish sort them out, put the good into baskets, but threw out the bad. Now, who fishes here? Okay. When you go out fishing and you catch some fish that you don't want, what do you do with them? You release them, right? You throw them back in the water. Catch and release, right? Somebody at the 8 o'clock service suggested, or you use them for bait. And then someone else at the 8 o'clock service said, if they were really paying attention and if they were really bad fish, they'd give them to the Roman soldiers. But they're not just going to toss them in the garbage, right? Again, that's that whole morality play approach to these stories, and that's not where Jesus is coming from, and it's not what he's holding out for these people. This past week, I've been at Camp Galilee working with a bunch of screaming junior high kids, and this coming week, starting after the Aces game, I get to run back up there and spend the rest of the week working with a group of screaming senior high kids. And while I was up there this past week, by the way, I am delighted and thrilled to announce to you that I have finally finished the Book of Joy. Just saying. Thanks to my lovely, intelligent, deeply talented wife. Oh, God, finally, done with that. Sure, I'm way more joyful. The neat thing, at the end of the book, there's some wonderful practices in the very last chapter, things that we can actually do that engage a more joyful countenance, if you will. So I finished with that, and I picked up this amazing book called The Hidden Life of Trees. Has anybody read it or come across it? Okay. And it's been really interesting to be up at Galilee, hanging out with these young people, you know, hiking the trails of the Tahoe Rim, going out with them into the forests and the mountains, and just from the vantage point of this science. This is a German scientist who's been taking care of a forest now in some part of Germany for the past 40 years, and he's learned some amazing things that other scientists are also beginning to notice and measure. And one of the things, we talked about this maybe a year ago from an article that Marietta gave me, and I remember reading the article about how trees, they've discovered that trees communicate with one another through their root system, and fungi who are in a symbiotic relationship with the trees that help create this network of communication between the trees. And I remember reading the article that she gave me and going, yeah, whatever. I saw Avatar, got the movie, you know, move on. But it turns out that this is all for real, and this is now science that people are measuring, that trees communicate in this way. And while I was up there this past week, I came across a particular chapter in this book where he describes how when an infestation of beetles is about to take place, that one tree, the first tree that encounters a beetle, will then draw all the beetles to itself and at the same time put out a warning through the root system and these fungi in symbiotic relation, warning to all the other trees, and I can't remember which species of tree this was that he was describing. It might have been birch or something. Anyway, and all the other trees around this one tree can then begin to excrete a certain chemical that's laden in the wood that will ward them and protect them from the beetles. It'll repel the beetles. But the one tree takes all the beetles and sacrifices itself for the rest of the forest. What? And now we have a new story. I guarantee you, if Jesus were around and read about this science, he would be telling a story about the kingdom of heaven is like a tree who takes on the beetles who are about to infest the forest and warns the rest of the trees and sacrifices itself for the forest. Wow. So these stories of extravagance are intended to capture our imagination and see how the kingdom of heaven and the presence of God permeates all things. and the simplest of things. I mean, yeast and a woman and a net and fish and a pearl and wheat and a sower. I mean, on the stories go. It's the little things, the simple things in this life that if we're awake and alert and just watching what's going on, tromping through a forest with a bunch of junior high kids. I tried at the 8 o'clock to say the kingdom of heaven is like a group of screaming junior high kids, and the 8 o'clockers just went, no, no, no. Not buying it. It's like, okay, I tried. But to see all around us both the extravagance of God and the opportunity to share that extravagance with the rest of the world. And so, take a moment. Take a nice deep breath.